If not, let's stand. We'll read Revelation chapter 22, verses 14 and 15. Blessed are they that do his commandments, that they may have right to the tree of life and may enter in through the gates into the city. For without are dogs and sorcerers and whoremongers and murderers and idolaters and whosoever loveth and maketh a lie. You may be seated. I will mention some of these people who are dogs and sorcerers and whoremongers and murderers and idolaters and who loveth and maketh a lie in this sermon. But we'll start off with that the bishop of the Diocese of Covington Catholic High School went and talked to the students without any parents allowed. He apologized to the students for making comments without knowing all the facts. The bishop of the Covington Diocese of Kentucky apologized Friday to the teenager at the center of a controversy over the behavior of Covington High School students toward a Native American elder in Washington. In a letter to parents, the Most Reverend Roger Foy said that the diocese was too quick to condemn the actions of the Covington Catholic High School students, particularly those of Nicholas Sandman, the boy who was seen on video facing off with Native American elder Nathan Phillips as he performed the song American Indian Movement near the Lincoln Memorial. Here's a quote. We should not have allowed ourselves to be bullied and pressured into making a statement prematurely, and we take full responsibility for it. Foes wrote, I especially apologize to Nicholas Sandman and his family, as well as to all CoveCalf families who have felt abandoned during this ordeal. And that's the end of his quote. The statement made international headlines, and teenagers from the Cincinnati suburbs were captured on video January 18th, doing a high school chant and surrounding Native Americans near the Washington Memorial. They were on a school trip to participate in the March for Life, an anti-abortion event. Many of the students were wearing MAGA hats. Phillips said some chanted, build the wall, about President Donald Trump's vow to build a wall along the U.S.-Mexico border. An initial video shared on social media appeared to show Phillips and a few other Native Americans surrounded by teenagers who looked as if they were taunting and chanting at the troop. Some young people performed what was described by critics as the tomahawk chop hand motion. Quote, Nicholas unfortunately has become the face of these allegations based on video clips, unquote, the bishop wrote. Quote, this is not fair, it is not just, unquote. Here's a photo of Covington Catholic High School on January the 20th. Remember the snow that we had that particular day. Foy said students and others connected to Covington have endured hatred and death threats in the wake of the incident. He said an investigative team has been engaged to get the bottom of what happened in Washington. And another quote from him, we apologize to anyone who has been offended in any way, unquote, he said in the letter. Well, Salmon's family hired a public relations firm to help him negotiate media attention. He told NBC's Today show that he was not trying to show disrespect. Quote, people have judged me based off one expression, which I wasn't smirking, unquote, he said. And there's a picture of him during the interview with Savannah Guthrie on the Today show. Both Sandman and Phillips said they felt threatened. Phillips, also appearing on today's show, separately said, even though I'm angry, I still have that forgiveness in my heart for those students, unquote. Many Americans came to the defense of the teenager after additional video from the confrontation showed that the students had been verbally attacked by a group of Hebrew Israelites. After that, the video showed Phillips approached and began performing the song. Sandman did not apologize. Quote, "I mean, in hindsight, I wish we could have walked away and avoided the whole thing," unquote, he said on Today. He added, quote, "but I can't say that I'm sorry for listening to him and standing there," unquote. Hallelujah. The case is finally about over. It should die down now. But wait. Nick Sandman went to play intramural basketball Sunday in school. As he took the court to play, a phone call was made, and soon the word was that Nick was to go home and stay until the bishop determined the truth of what happened. He was required to take an interview with a third party, or he could not return to school. So Nicholas has missed school Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. There were snow days involved. I don't know what happened. He is suspended for doing nothing, and he will stay suspended because his own lawyer told him not to participate in any interview session with a third party. What will happen to him? Will he get his tuition refunded? What will the other students do? The bishop is getting many of the parents at Covington Catholic very angry. Nathan Phillips, the former drunk, an AWOL serviceman, prisoner, and present liar, is getting a free pass by most of the people who saw the video. He, who was adopted at the age of 5 by a non-Indian family with the name Standard, was trying to disrupt a Catholic mass on Saturday night in the same way he tried to disrupt the Covington Catholic group. He was beating his drum, with his 20 followers marching behind him. The security guards had to lock the doors of the basilica to keep the rowdy Indians from disrupting the service of the Mass. But who was the real offensive ones? One, Covington Catholic. Two, the unusual Indian. Or three, the black Hebrew Israelites. This is the real strange thing about this case. It was the black Hebrew Israelites who were shouting insults at everyone who came around them. They were even making derogatory statements towards the President of the United States. But I have yet to see anyone write or say that they needed to apologize and be punished in some way. Why have the black Hebrew Israelites got off freely? Is it because of who their head leader is? Rabbi Capers Finney? What is it? Funny? First cousin once removed of the former First Lady of the United States, Michelle Obama. Funday's mother, Verdell Robinson Funday, and Mrs. Obama's paternal grandfather, Fraser Robinson Jr., was sister and brother. Funday is chief rabbi at the Beth Shalom B'nai Zakan Ethiopian Hebrew Congregation in southwest Chicago. He is well known in Jewish circles for acting as a bridge between mainstream Jewry and the much smaller and largely separate world of the black Jewish congregation, sometimes known as black Hebrews or black Israelites. He has often urged the larger Jewish community to be more accepting of Jews who are not white. Well, I add, Jews themselves are not white. They are a mixed breed. Rabbi Capers received his ordination from the Israelite Rabbinical Academy of New York. Raised in the African Methodist Episcopal Church, Bunny Capers became involved in civil rights and black nationalism while studying at Howard University. Under the guidance of Rabbi Robert Devine, leader of the House of Israel's congregation in Chicago, he adopted Devine's teachings that Africans were descended from biblical Hebrews and that Jesus was the Messiah and he was black. Funday Capers eventually rejected the Christian elements of the movement and studied with Rabbi Levi Ben Levi in Brooklyn, who embraced the concept of African originalism, but whose approach to observance and belief were more in line with mainstream Judaism. In 1985, Funday Capers converted to Judaism at a conservative bent then. that has told his followers that his decision to convert does not imply his followers need to follow suit. Rabbi Levi also ordained Rabbi Finlay Capers as a rabbi, although no mainstream denomination has accepted the title or Levi's right to confer it. The issue mainstream Jewish movements have with the black Israelites, distinct from race, is that they do not recognize their conversions, which in some cases involve similar rituals as mainstream conversions, such as immersion in ritual bath and circumcision for males. Where they fall short is the part 12th century scholar Maimonides considered paramount, acceptance of the yoke of Jewish halakha and of the sages. Finlay Capers said of the First Lady, Michelle Obama, quote, "Our families were very close. All through my childhood, our families were in and out of each other's houses, celebrating holidays together, that kind of thing," unquote. And the media press does not tell anything about that. Just as President Obama has been able to stimulate dialogue on race, given his role as president, Finlay Capers says he plans to use his title to create awareness and understanding about race in the Jewish world. He has already met with Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and has discussed with him issues relating to the Ethiopian community in Israel. Rabbi Capers told the Chicago Tribune, quote, "Unfortunately, by and large, when you see any imagery of Jews in the United States, very seldom do you see members of my community. We have to remember that Jews have always been a global people," unquote. And that is true. A Chicago black pastor, Jeremiah Wright, who used to minister to the Obama family, in 2008 blamed, quote, "them Jews," unquote, of keeping him and Barack Obama apart. He also suggested that, quote, "the Jewish vote, the AIPAC vote, was controlling Obama," unquote. Jane Ramsey, then executive director for the Council of Jewish Affairs, welcomed the contribution of Rabbi Capers in engaging the African American community. Quote, "He's deeply religious and deeply devoted to Judaism and deeply devoted to creating jobs and housing and addressing racism and anti-Semitism," unquote, she said. Finally, list from Mick Sandman's attorneys, L. Lynn Wood and Todd McMurtry. Quote, "On January 18th, in the span of a few hours, Nick Sandman's peaceful attendance with his Covington Catholic classmates at the March for Life in Washington, D.C. was turned into a personal nightmare when Nick became the focus of false and defamatory accusations published and broadcast across the nation and the world. A mob comprised of activists, church and school officials, members of the mainstream print and broadcast media, and individuals on social media, including elected public officials and celebrities, rushed to condemn and vilify this young man by burying him in an avalanche of false accusations, false portrayals, and cyberbullying that have threatened his reputation and his personal safety. Nick Sandman is 16 years old. He is an 11th grade high school student. He is not the face of evil, and he did absolutely nothing wrong or inappropriate in connection with the incident to deserve the heinous accusations made against him by uninformed or agenda-driven individuals and media entities. Nick and his family have experienced one of the worst sides of our present society. As their lawyers, we intend to exercise our best efforts as advocates to show Nick and his family another side of our society, that we are a society that survives and flourishes from the fact that it is based on the rule of law, a system of justice that demands that truth prevail and the wrongdoers be held accountable for the harm they have inflicted on Nick and his family. In the coming weeks, we will be carefully reviewing all the false accusation and threats made against Nick. We fully expect that a multitude of civil lawsuits will be filed and aggressively pursued. We recognize that justice for Nick will not be achieved quickly, but we are dedicated to achieving it for this young man, regardless of time or expense. At this time, Nick, his family, and their lawyers will not be engaging in media interviews. There is work to be done. Nick and his family sincerely appreciate the fair-minded individuals who respect our system of justice and refuse to rush to judgment before the truth was revealed. Our efforts are not about politics, race, or religion. Our efforts are only about justice for Nick, unquote. We will keep you posted on what happens in this lawsuit and case. Now back to the sermon. After almost 100 years of humiliation and the double defeat by David Sassoon and his mercenary British army, China finally eliminated drug usage in its nation. At its worst, China had one-third of the nation as addicts. A third of the people were addicts. It had lost two major wars with Sassoon and the British, and their peace treaties were even worse. But in four short years, it had become practically a drug-free nation. That's incredible. Shortly after World War II in 1949, China had gained control of its drug addiction problem. It had provided rehab to many of the users, murdered many of the drug dealers, and stopped the importation of the drugs, including opium. China was finally relatively drug-free after 100 years of major drug addiction. It took just four short years. So beginning like 1950, it's drug-free. But very few people ever asked the next question, which should be obvious. If the drug business, which was all Jewish, was so profitable that many Jews made fortunes that are still inherited today, what did they do with their business if China was no longer an option? If illegal drugs were no longer available to be sent to the Chinese market, what would they do with all the opium? The answer, they simply moved it to other countries. When did we start to get a drug problem? Where did they move it? To Europe, America, Australia, and so forth. What happened in America, one of the territories to which they moved the Jewish drug selling operation? But before I get to all that, I'm going to talk about first the history of how drug use began. Was very little known, and when the ill effects of the drugs were secretly kept under wraps from the public. The opiate-based drug morphine was created in the year 1803. It was widely used during the American misnamed Civil War, 1861 to 1865, as an injectable brain pain reliever, leading to the first wave of morphine addiction. So in the Civil War, a lot of people got morphine, they become addicted, so they get addicted. The practice of smoking opium was introduced in the 1950s and 60s by Chinese, 1850s and 1860s by Chinese laborers who came to the United States to work on railroads. Some Chinese men started coming to the United States around 1820, and some larger groups appeared in the 1830s and 40s. These men were coming to America to work as merchants, to mine gold, and for other work opportunities. The first Chinese woman to come to America, Afang Mai, arrived in 1834. By the 1860s, Chinese immigration became more common, and Chinese men helped build the first transcontinental railroad. The Chinese population on the West Coast grew quickly by the time the railroad began construction. It is estimated that between 1850 and 1889, 300,000 Chinese people immigrated to America, though many of them ended up going back to China. Chinese workers first became a perceived threat to the white male workers in the 1870s when there was a work shortage. White Americans viewed these Chinese men as racially inferior and felt they were taking work away from them. The Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882 banned Chinese immigration for 10 years, and it was extended another 10 years by the Geary Act of 1892. They must have been racist. Prejudice against the Chinese in America remained for decades. When Congress passed the Harrison Tax Act of 1914, which effectively outlawed opium nationwide, it became another measure to gain power over the Chinese population. This is how drugs started in America. But before we continue as to what happened when they skyrocketed use, let's look at one family in America, the Russell family. The Russell family was influential in many ways in America and was one of the most profitable of the drug smuggling operations in China. The Russell family were German Jews who immigrated to Scotland, then to Northern Ireland, and then to America. The following are five facts about the Russell family and how they influenced America. The first, two Restoration religions began. Restoration churches taught that there was no true Christian church left in the world at that time. So their church was chosen to be the church that restored true Christianity back into the world. The Christian church went on right down the road, and its spinoff, the Church of Christ, were one of these restoration churches. But they soon split over playing of musical instruments in the church. Mormonism was another restoration church. Mormonism, Missouri, under the leadership of Joseph Smith, Jr., and its spinoff, Mormonism of Utah, under the leadership of Brigham Young, along with the split of the Mormons under the leadership of Isaac Russell, were other restoration churches that started in the 1800s. Remember, the Russell family were German Jews who immigrated to Scotland, then to Northern Ireland, and then to America. Russell, who was born near Austin, England, and his family were baptized into the Church of Latter-day Saints on May 21, 1836, by Parley P. Pratt, along with the families of John Taylor, who happened to be the third president of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the Utah branch, and others. He would join the body of Latter-day Saints in Kirkland, Ohio in 1837, which is now located in Greater Cleveland, Ohio. As the Latter-day Saints were fleeing Missouri in the winter of 1838 and 39, Russell claimed to have received revelations directing him to remain in Missouri by leading the church into Indian Territory, where the three neophytes would join them to convert the Lamertons. His organization was called the Austin Church, named after the town near where he was born. He was alleged to have said that Joseph Smith had fallen and that he, Isaac, was now the prophet. On April 26, 1839, Russell, along with most, if not all, of his followers, were excommunicated. Russell stayed in the far west among anti-Mormon mobs, never rejoining the Latter-day Saints, and died in 1844 on his farm near Richmond, Missouri, of swamp fever. His youngest child, Isabella Russell, born a year before his death, later wrote his biography. In 1861, Mary Russell, Isaac's widow, moved her children to Salt Lake City and rejoined the Mormon Church under the leadership of Brigham Young. Another Russell, Captain Joseph H. Russell, was an original investor in stock in the Mormon Deseret Manufacturing Company, which was an umbrella company for many early Mormon enterprises. Another Russell opened a store with Mormon blessings in the newly created Salt Lake City store called Miller, Russell, and Company. It was a primary source of goods to the area of Utah. Later in the century, another false church was started by Charles T. Russell. Jehovah's Witness began as a Bible study class in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Remember, the Russells were German Jews who immigrated to Scotland, Northern Ireland, and then America. Charles Taz Russell was a friend of the Jewish Rothschilds and received financial support for his organization from international bankers via the Freemasons and the Jewish Order of the B'nai B'rith. He was one of the first Zionists in America and was also deeply involved in the occult. Second, the founding of Yale University. William Huntington Russell, along with James Pierpont and nine other Congregational Church ministers, and the Collins and Illuminati family and the Unitarian Church, were involved in the founding of Collegiate University. In 1718, the name of the college was changed after Elihu Yale was asked for financial help in constructing a new building for the college. Yale, who had made a fortune through trade while living in Madras, India, as a representative of the British East India Company selling opium to China, donated a substantial sum. See part 5 of this series of sermons. The college changed its name to Yale College. I studied American history, and I wasn't taught about this opium trade to China being a powerful influence. The Jewish Russell family intermarried with the Perkins and Sturgis families and formed half a dozen companies, including Russell and Company. The Russell Kinship Business Group also included the Bull, Cabot, Carrington, Delano, Forbes, Shaw, and Wetmore families, who got their opium from Smyrna, which is now Izmir, Turkey. The opium business to China was limited to Jews exclusively. I quoted that where they were, David Sasson only hired Jews for his business. In 1823, Samuel Russell established Russell and Company for acquiring opium in Turkey and smuggling it to China. Russell and Company merged with Perkins, the Boston Syndicate, 1830, and became the primary American opium smuggler. Many of the great American and European fortunes were built on the China opium trade. Let's repeat that last sentence, as it is very important, and most people are not aware of it. Most people have never ever heard of it before. Here it is. Many of the great American and European fortunes were built on the China or opium trade. For example, a few of the Russell and Company's chiefs of operation in Canton were, number one, Warren Delano Jr., whose close descendants were three United States presidents. Number two, John Cleve Green, who financed Princeton University. Number three, Abel Lowe, who financed construction of Columbia University. Four, Joseph Coolidge and the Perkins, Sturgis, and Forbes families. Coolidge's son organized United Fruit Company And his grandson, Archibald C. Coolidge, was a co-founder of the Council of Foreign Relations. Now I've got a picture of Ishmael. There's Ishmael, Turkey. That's where they got the opium. That's where the Americans got the opium to sell with China. Oh, this family is something else. There's more. Third, in 1832, Skull and Bones, the secret society of senior fourth-year graduate students at Yale University, New Haven, Connecticut, that was founded in 1832. Male society members called Bonesmen, and many have ascended after graduation to position of prominence in business or government. Three of them, William Howard Taft, George Herbert Walker Bush, and George Walker Bush became presidents of the United States, and another one, John Kerry, came in a close second to George Walker Bush. Skull and Bones was formed in 1832 by William Huntington O'Russell and Adolphus Taft. Other sources conjecture that Russell modeled the society after European groups he encountered while studying in Germany. The emblem of society is a skull and bones. Well, it's a pirate insignia with the number 322 beneath it. The society's clubhouse is a monumental brownstone building in New Haven called the Tomb. Originally built in 1856, the Tomb was doubled in size in 1903 and has since been further enlarged. It chooses 15 new members every spring at a ceremony called Tap Day or Tap Night. Juniors are notified of their selection by a society member who ritually claps them on the shoulder. The society has always kept its affairs secret, but for many years it publicized its membership roster. Some new members are high-achieving students, while others are descendants of socially prominent families. Even though Yale University has admitted women since 1969, females were not granted membership into Skull and Bones until 1992. The family names on the Skull and Bones roster roll off the tongue like an elite party list. Lord, Whitney, Taft, Jay, Bundy, Harriman, Weyerhaeuser, Pinchot, Rockefeller, Goodyear, Sloan, Stinson, Phelps, Perkins, Pillsbury, Kellogg, Vanderbilt, Bush, Lovett, and so on. George H.W. Bush was a director of the Jew-controlled CIA and nicknamed Poppy by his family because of his patriarchal status and association with the opium smuggling that can be traced to founders of Yale's Skull and Bones Society, into which both he and his son George W. have been inducted. The George H.W. Bush family has been called the, quote, American cocaine cartel extraordinaire, unquote, because of his links to drug smuggling in Indochina after the Vietnam War, along with drug runners like Dr. Sun Mung Moon and other Korean cult leaders who invest followers' funds in narcotics and methamphetamine distribution by Jew-controlled drug lords from North Korea to Japan, the United States, and South America. Now you know what that war, you think about what that war is all about. Associates of George H.W. Bush in the narcotics trade have included Errol Sharon and David Rockefeller, who worked with the CIA and the Mossad to smuggle narcotics via oil pipelines and use banks in Israel and New York to launder the proceeds. This partly explains disputes over oil pipeline routes in places like the Caucasus, Iraq, and Afghanistan in recent times. The father of William Russell was Nodiah Russell, one of the founders of Collegiate College, or Yale University. William became a shipper for the Russell & Company, who had its company's logo, the Skull and Bones. William made his fortune selling opium to China. Well, the fourth incident is that Warren Delano became shipping with Russell and Company. The Delanos were descendants of the Italian or Spanish Jewish family, Delano, Dillon, or Delano. The Jew Delano drafted an agreement with the West Indies Company in 1657 regarding the colonization of the island of Curacao. About this, the directors of the West Indies Company had correspondence with the governor of New Holland. He became a lead slave, an opium shipper, as well as a leader of pirates. So he shipped slaves, opium, and he was a pirate. In America, as in Europe, pretty much everything was deemed fair in the pursuit of profits. The love of money is the root of all evil. Such was the outlook at Russell and Company, a Boston concern whose clipper ships made it the leader in the lucrative American trade in Chinese tea and silk and opium. In 1823, Warren Delano sailed to Canton, China, where he did so well that within 7 years, he was a senior partner in Russell and Company. Delano's problem, as with all traders, European and American, was that China had much to sell but declined to buy. The Manchu emperors believed that the Middle Kingdom already possessed everything worth having and hence needed no barbarian manufacturers. The British struck upon an ingenious way to reduce a huge trade deficit. Their merchant bribed Chinese officials to allow entry of chests of opium from British rule to India, though its importation had long been banned by imperial decree. Imports soared, and nearly every American company followed suit, acquiring, quote-unquote, black dirt in Turkey, or as its agents for Indian producers. Yet as addiction grew more numerous and became more epidemic, and as the Chinese began paying with precious silver for their drug, their emperor finally in 1839 named an imperial commissioner to end the trade. Commissioner Lin too soon proceeded to Canton, seized vast stocks of opium, and dumped the chests in the sea. This produced a melee in which drunken sailors killed a Chinese villager, furnished a spark for the opium war initiated by Lord Palmerston, the British Prime Minister, and waged with determination to obtain full compensation for the opium. The Celestial Empire was humbled, forced to open 5 ports to foreign traders and to permit a British colony at Hong Kong. But it is noteworthy that the war was denounced in Parliament as unjust and iniquitous by 30-year-old William Edward Gladstone, who accused Palmerston of hoisting the British flag, quote, to protect an infamous contraband traffic, unquote. The same outrage was expressed in the pulpit. Oh, the churches, the pulpit, and the press in America and England, thereby encouraging Russell and Company and most other American businesses to pull out of the opium trade. But Warren Delano returned to America rich, and in 1851 settled in Newburgh, New York. The old China trader was close-mouthed about opium, as were his partners in Russell and Company. Fifth, Russell and Company's partner, Warren Delano Jr., was the father of Frederick A. Delano, the vice chairman of the Federal Reserve Bank during World War I, and Sarah Delano. The family tree of the Delanos branch off into this two-generation formation. Delano had a son, Frederick Delano, who was chairman of the Federal Reserve Bank, and his daughter, Sarah Delano. Sarah Delano had a son who was Franklin Delano Roosevelt. One of Delano's sons, the high officer of the Jewish Federal Reserve Banking System, and his daughter was the mother of Franklin Roosevelt. Teddy Roosevelt was also a descendant of Warren Delano, and he was president of the United States before his cousin Franklin was. But that is not all. Calvin Coolidge was also a descendant of the man who made a fortune in opium smuggling in China. Now, President Franklin D. Roosevelt's middle name, D, is short for Delano. Warren Delano was the president's grandfather on his mother's side. Claes Rosenfeld entered the cloth business in New York and was married in 1682. He accumulated a fortune. His son Nicholas changed his last name. He added the letter O and dropped the letter N. So Rosenfeld became Roosevelt. Now let's look at the family tree. Leave it here when I read the next paragraph. But up at the top, you got Claes Rosenfeld. He had two sons, Jonas and Jacobus. Now, the first Roosevelt came to America in 1649. His name was Claes Rosenfeld. He's up at the top. R-O-S-E-N-F-E-L-T, Rosenfeld. He was a Jew. Nicholas, the son of Claes, was an ancestor of both Franklin and Theodore, both presidents of the United States. So he had a son, Nicholas. He's up at the top. Nicholas married a Jewish girl named Kunst in 1682. Nicholas had a son named Jacobus Rosenfeld. Five generations later, James Rosenfeld, now Rosenfeld, married Rebecca B. Rohalan, and her death married his second wife, Sarah Rose Delano, who was a sixth cousin 4 years later. Their offspring was Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who married Anna Eleanor Roosevelt. Roosevelt married Roosevelt. Did you know that? Well, yeah, it says here, Teddy Roosevelt gave Eleanor away at her wedding as her father had died when she was just 10 years old. So there's the family. The Roosevelts were devoted to being merchants. One of the earlier family members founded the Bank of New York in 1790. They were a privileged social caste in the United States, with their inheritance funded by mostly illegal money in the opium trade with China. People start saying white privilege class. It should be Jewish privilege class. Now I'm going to talk a little bit about Sarah Delano. The president's father married Sarah Delano. The Delanos were descendants of an Italian or Spanish Jewish family. The Jew Delano drafted an agreement with the West Indies Company, 1657, regarding colonization of the island of Curacao. I read this already. Then we got a picture of Franklin with his wife's family. Built about 1832 by Warren Delano I on land purchased from the Roch family, the Delano homestead, 39 Walnut Street, Fairhaven, Maine, remained in the family for about 110 years. Additional wings were added onto the house subsequently, but removed and remodeled into self-standing homes following the sale of the property in 1942. FDR's first visit to Fairhaven was during the summer following his birth in 1882. Notably, it was here in 1903 in this house following Thanksgiving dinner that Franklin announced to his mother that he had become engaged to Anna Eleanor Roosevelt. The last visit to the homestead by the President and Mrs. Roosevelt came on October 21, 1936. The couple dined with the President's mother, Sarah, who had arrived in town the night before. Now, here's where it gets very interesting, and I didn't know all this. Franklin Roosevelt, or Rosenfeld, and that the Rosenfeld should be an F instead of a V in Rosenfeld, had a very strange marriage with Eleanor. I don't know if you knew this either. In 1918, Eleanor was devastated to discover that Franklin was having an affair with her secretary, Lucy Mercer. When Eleanor threatened to leave him, now this is 1918, divorce is very rare. It would ruin his political crime. He wasn't even winning president yet. So she threatened to leave him. His mother, Sarah, intervened and offered to support Eleanor financially with all the drug money if she would stay in the marriage. After that, Eleanor and Franklin maintained the public facade of a married couple, but lived as platonic partners who shared an interest in public service. Since the discovery in 1918, the two slept in separate beds every night thereafter for 27 years. But Franklin, with the help of his daughter, Anna, continued to rendezvous with Mercer, and she was in Warm Springs, Georgia, the day Franklin died. Eleanor was conspicuously absent. Mercer died in South Carolina in 1948. There has been plenty of speculation that FDR had his fair of mistresses after he and Eleanor no longer shared a bed. Franklin had a long-standing affair with another one of his secretaries, Missy Lehan. There was also reportedly a sexual relationship with Post publisher Dorothy Shift, who claimed her husband was fine with the affair. But none of the alleged affairs ever captured as much intrigue as the relationship with Lucy Mercer. But FDR maintained at least three affairs. His estranged wife reportedly had a few of her own. Well, Hillary's looking better every time here. The fallout from the Lucy Mercer scandal drove Eleanor to have a liaison with female reporter Lorinda Hickok that took place while FDR was president. Frank and Eleanor may have had their mistresses living at the White House at the same time. Hickok moved into the White House in 1940. Franklin was a whoremonger, and Eleanor became a lesbian. No matter what else Franklin Delano Roosevelt was romantically involved with, Mercer was never completely out of the picture. She is reportedly at his inauguration hiding in a private limousine, which FDR reportedly sent for her. When he died in 1945, it was Lucy and not Eleanor who was by his side. Another interesting tidbit about Roosevelt was that he contracted an illness in 1921, at the time believed to be polio, which paralyzed Roosevelt from the waist down. This was 3 years after he and Eleanor began sleeping in different beds. For the rest of his life, Roosevelt was partly paralyzed. He tried a lot of therapies, including hydrotherapy, and in 1926, he purchased a resort in Warm Springs, Georgia, where he founded a hydrotherapy center for treatment of polio patients, which still operates as the Roosevelt Warm Springs Institute for Rehabilitation. After he became president, he helped begin the National Foundation for Infantile Paralysis, now known as the March of Dimes. His leadership in this organization is one reason he is commemorated on the dime. At the time when the private lives of public figures were subject to less scrutiny than they are today, Roosevelt was able to convince many people that he was in fact getting better, which he believed was needed if he was to run for public office again. Fitting his hips and legs with iron braces, he laboriously taught himself to walk a short distance by swiveling his torso while supporting himself with a cane. In private, he used a wheelchair, but he was careful never to use it in public. He usually appeared in public standing upright, supported on one side by an aide or one of his sons. In 2003, a peer-reviewed study found it was more likely that Roosevelt's paralysis illness was Guillain-Barre syndrome and not polio. Well, my conclusion. All during President Franklin Delano Roosevelt's tour of office, very few of the citizens of the United States knew that he was paralyzed from the waist down. The media kept it covered up. He manipulated the photographs of him so that his handicaps were played down. It was also true of all his mistresses that both he and Eleanor had. It was also true about his wealth that he inherited from his drug-smuggling grandfather. It was also true about the real reason America's Great Depression, usury banking. What is different about today? The Jewish media is still controlling what we think, what we believe, and who we should vote for or against. They have kept hidden the monopoly that certain families in America have, and the place that they played in the leadership of certain religions, the fortunes that they made, especially in the drug arenas, education, and in politics. They will eventually recover from the Covington Catholic issue, just like they have recovered from the Sandy Hook massacre, the 9/11 disaster, and the Las Vegas shooting. But they will not win. To be continued, blessed be the Lord God of Israel.